back for hour number two here on our Bible study program. It is Good Friday, and we just finished dealing with Matthew 27. Those verses there in the middle of the 27th chapter, verses 32 through 44, that give Matthew's description of the crucifixion event. If you'd like to talk about that, you can do that here on our Ask the Pastor program. The phone lines are wide open. Our numbers are 505-7850 and 1-800-730-2727. We say good morning and welcome to our guest who is with us here on the telephone. He is Dr. Paul Meyer, and he is a historian. He is the second vice president of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod and a teacher at Western Michigan University. What is your title there, Dr. Meyer?
I'm professor of ancient history.
Ancient history.
That's right.
That doesn't make you an ancient guy, does it?
Well, I think they're starting to switch the adjective now. I've been doing it for 40-plus years,
wow.
And so they refer to me as the ancient professor of history, but it works both ways.
And the university in which you teach is not a religious university. It's a secular.
No, it's secular.
It's a secular university. On days like today, do you feel like a fish out of water a little bit? Because, after all, you're an ordained man in the midst of an otherwise secular setting. What's the feeling?
Actually, I'm on sabbatical this year, and so I don't notice any difference.
So you
whatever.
Can do whatever you want.
That's exactly right. But the climate here seems to be attuned to the dismal nature of the day because we have a snowstorm hitting us once again in this worst of all winters.
Where is Western Michigan University in that state?
Kalamazoo.
Is that, that's kind of like middle, lower middle.
No, it's halfway between Detroit and Chicago.
Oh, okay. All right, and you've got a snowstorm, do you?
That's true.
Well, let me ask you a question. We just got done describing through Matthew's eyes the crucifixion of Jesus, and I know enough about the Gospels to know that all four Gospels, while they are fairly similar in nature, they give differing details on various things. After we're done looking at all four Gospels and the descriptions of the crucifixion death of Jesus there, is that pretty much the sum and total of the facts and details that are available, or do you, as a historian, have access to any other information that Bible readers don't ordinarily get?
Well, my specialty over the last 30 or 40 years of research has been to try to beat the bushes of the ancient world to come up with additional evidence that does correlate with the New Testament account in order to enhance it, in order to give us more detail. We certainly don't have a complete transcript of the trial of Jesus of Nazareth before Pontius Pilate, or even a complete trial of the true crucifixion. We have everything we need to know, but more would have happened that day, and I've always been trying to find out what that more is, and it's been a fun research.
Are you generally frustrated in your 35 to 40 years of research that there hasn't been more, or were you pleasantly surprised at what you did discover?
No, quite the opposite. Pleasantly surprised at how beautifully the biblical record does correlate with everything we know about Greco-Roman history and the history of law at the time and punishments and nature of crucifixion. And, you know, when you set it against the background of the ancient world, you see how very reliable the accounts are in the gospel records.
Recently, within the last year or so, some prominent atheists have stepped forward, and they have a way of reacting to statements like you just made with maybe we could call it disrespect, disbelief. They plant the seeds in people that the biblical accounts or the historical accounts are incomplete or inaccurate or conflicting and create doubt among people. They might say, well, that's what we would expect Dr. Meyer to say because, after all, he's a pastor and he's a reverend. Well, of course he's going to say that.
Well, they're not the only ones, I regret to say. Some theologians who ought to know better are also joining the chorus of critics and have tried to superimpose a question mark over many aspects of the account of the Passion. Quite the opposite is the case. In fact, sure, the atheists have finally come out. I was wondering what took them so long. I was convinced that after the 9/11 episode, you know, where the issue of theodicy is involved, how could God let this happen? I thought they'd be coming out in droves, and
what did you
took
call
them
that?
Until this past year to do it.
What did you call that, theodicy?
Theodicy, yeah.
What does that mean?
Well, that means trying to figure out God's ways in terms of the apparent evil in this world. How can a good God permit evil and this sort of thing?
Yeah.
So I was really waiting for that chorus to come out much earlier.
And I wonder why it didn't.
I also wonder why. I guess they finally got the word that this might be a good opportunity.
So what's your meditation on this March 21st, Good Friday?
Well, I'm convinced that Christianity's intersection always begins with fact and not fiction. It is closely, intimately intertwined with the facts of what really took place in the past at a real corner of the world, part of the Roman Empire, which certainly did exist, and every aspect of the Passion story is borne out by similar names, personalities, institutions, all your political people, for example, that show up in the Gospels are absolutely true personalities. We can give you more detail on their background, much more in some cases than even the Bible will tell us. We know far more about the Herods, for example, who were in charge. One of them, Herod Antipas, the son of Herod the Great, has a bit part on Good Friday, as you well know, when Pontius Pilate invokes a change of venue in the trial and proceedings. Well, we know a lot more about him. It's just so fascinating to see how, in many cases, we get a tip of the iceberg in the case of the Gospels, but there is a definite iceberg there, and it's fun to explore also the lower extremities.
Dr. Meyer, for a person who might say something like this, you know, I don't care what Dr. Meyer discovers about the Herods. I don't care what they discover about Pontius Pilate. I don't care how many ossuaries they discover. None of that matters. Anything. All I need, by golly, is the four Gospels, and I get all the information I need from that, and that's sufficient for my faith. How would you respond to that?
Occasionally, I do get that objection. In my seminars, I have three major seminars: one's on Jesus, and one's on his greatest missionary, Saint Paul, and the third one's on the early church. And very often, after giving 4.5 hours of new information, some sweet person in the back row will raise her hand and say, "Dr. Meyer, do we really need all this? Isn't the Bible enough?" Well, of course it is. And I'm not trying to knock the sacred record at all. But I am saying the sacred record is so very, very historically verifiable that to doubt it is just folly in terms of the facts that we do have. So what I do is not bring people to faith via this new information. Of course not. The Bible does that as a means of grace through the Holy Spirit. But what I do is I try to clear the trash away from the temple door, as the expression goes, to give people some reason to doubt their doubts. Because so often, especially in view of all the sensationalist put-downs, the radical theologians' approach, the atheists currently over this past year, they do begin to have doubts, and I'm simply pointing out that it's time to doubt the doubts, because the facts are so very, very clear.
I think that when we go to a Maundy Thursday service or a Good Friday service, Easter Sunday, and we hear the readings and we listen to the preaching or the teaching, I can't help but form an image in my mind of the way these things might have looked. A lot of us recall an image that we got maybe from a movie somewhere, and that's what we carry around with us. I'm wondering, for example, when you're sitting in church on a Good Friday evening and you're listening to the biblical account, if you have an image in your mind that is fuller than mine because of all the research that you've done, are there details, is there a depth there that you have that you might share with us in order to add some color to my picture?
Well, for one thing, what has helped me most is actually being on site in the Holy Land to see how these various sacred sites in regard to the Passion story hold up on a ground level view, shall we say.
When you went to the Holy Land, did it look like you expected it was going?
No,
to
there are always surprises there.
So,
oh yeah.
So
the Garden of Gethsemane on the wrong side of Jerusalem. You know, in my original Sunday school days, I pictured it at one side, and it turns out to be just the opposite on the east side instead. Well, these are minor little items, but when you've been on the site. And I've just returned, as a matter of fact, 48 hours ago from a tour that I led to Israel and Egypt.
Really?
And so it was, you're hitting me fresh with a question like that. So it's very convenient to see exactly how this all works. You know, some critics say that all these events couldn't have happened in the detail that John's Gospel gives them. Well, I took a stopwatch and I walked through all the stages of Jesus from the upper room, down the stairs to the Kidron River, across to the Garden of Gethsemane, and then the arrest about 10 p.m. on Thursday night, and then the being dragged to the high priest's palace, again in Mount Zion area of Jerusalem, and then off to the pavement of Pontius Pilate, which was in the west part of the city, then the change of venue to the Maccabean Palace, which was halfway eastward to the temple area, then back again. It all works. It all works at almost exactly the time required, even with additional dialogue.
So, have you been to Golgotha?
Oh, certainly.
When you first laid eyes on Golgotha, did it take your breath away, or were you disappointed? Did it not measure up to your preconceived
notion? Well, I think almost anyone who sees Golgotha for the first time has to be disappointed. I'll tell you why. I warned my people ahead of time that they're not going to like what they see because Christians for 2,000 years have shown their yearning to be close to the Lord by all the incredible religious paraphernalia they've loaded on the spot. And so today it is very disappointing, I think. And that's the reason why an alternate version for Golgotha, called Gordon's Calvary, gained a lot of popularity among some Protestants. It's still very popular, even though it has no authenticity. Now, here's the reason. Originally, the hill of Golgotha, the skull place, was just outside the Joppa Gate in the midwestern section of the old city of Jerusalem. But then, later on, of course, Jerusalem's been destroyed and rebuilt 13 times since Jesus' day, so that the Western Wall has now gone beyond that and incorporated the site within the city today. And so people say, oh, well, this can't be the proper place because it's inside the city wall. But hold it. We're talking about a city that has changed dramatically in the last 2,000 years. And so we would expect to find it inside the city now, not outside the city. But the historicity of the site is very, very well documented. Constantine, as we know, was the first Christian emperor, urged on by his pious mother Helena. He asked the Christian bishop of Jerusalem in the year 326 A.D., did he know where Jesus was crucified? And the bishop's name was Macarius, and he could immediately reply that it was indeed at the hillock that was now going to be incorporated inside a new chapel that Constantine built called the Basilica of the Sepulchre, the Holy Sepulchre, Church of the Holy Sepulchre. And then the resurrection tomb, which was nearby, was originally kept in a separate, structured in a separate rotunda. And Constantine's engineers hacked Joseph's tomb, Arimathea's tomb, out of the precipice or the surrounding hillside, and then enclosed it in this rotunda, which they shouldn't have done, but they wanted to give it a special hallowed significance. Then, in the year 1000, the mad Sultan Hakim from Egypt Mameluke tore the whole affair down. And then the Crusaders came along and rebuilt the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, as it's called today, this time incorporating both Golgotha and the resurrection tomb under one roof. Now, I know that's disappointing right there, but the Gospel of John does tell us that, quote, there was in the place where Jesus was crucified a new tomb, which had not just been used, in the place where he was crucified. So it does work, and it's at one diagonal end of this enormous structure called the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. It, of course, is filled with all kinds of iconic imagery and art and incense and lanterns, and it just is really not very amenable to our taste. And so what I tell people in my group is close your eyes now and just imagine that in terms of longitude and latitude on Earth, this is where it happened. And don't be grossed out by what you see with your own eyes today.
If Jerusalem has been destroyed and rebuilt 13 times since the time of Jesus, how are you able to take a stopwatch and go to where the Sanhedrin might have had their trial and where Pilate might have had Jesus before him? And how do we know where those things were?
Well, there are some good indications on a very early map of Jerusalem, discovered at Medeba in Jordan, for example, from 3rd, 4th century, which shows the layout of the city of Jerusalem at the time. And the old city of Jerusalem itself is very much like the city in Jesus' day. And don't forget, Jerusalem, of course, has expanded enormously since those days, and so there's the rest of modern Jerusalem just dwarfs it. But that center old city of Jerusalem still nestles over the Brook Kidron, which runs between the walls of the old city and the Mount of Olives immediately eastward. Those are all authentic sites. And the stairs down to the Brook Kidron are also authentic and from Jesus' time. And some of the foundations of the walls are Herodian. We know that. The great Western Wall, the so-called Wailing Wall, at which Jews congregate today to bewail their past. It's real. Those are Herodian stones. When Jesus said there's not one stone going to be left upon another, he's talking primarily about the temple area and not the esplanade that supports it. And those stones are still there, and they are marvelously huge. I can understand why the disciples were impressed. So we know these are very definite location spots.
So when you take people to Israel and you say, now, we're going to go to Calvary here, it's going to be kind of disappointing. You have to brace them for that. Is there a moment on your tour where people are equally affected on the other side of the deal, where they're breathtaking, where maybe they're moved to tears, something like that?
Oh, you bet. Oh, you bet. There are many sites in Galilee in particular, especially the Sea of Galilee itself. It's just marvelous. Sea of Galilee today looks very much like it did in Jesus' day. It hasn't changed in 2,000 years. Everything from the Golan Heights to the east, to the Magdala in the west where Mary Magdalene came from, to Capernaum at the northern end, to where the Jordan River exits from the Sea of Galilee and then goes south. It's all there.
You take your group to the Sea of Galilee, and what do you tell them?
Well, this is where we read the gospel lessons and all the seascape stories. Or this past tour, we were able to celebrate Passion Sunday right on the Mount of the Beatitudes. And we, of course, use that as our scripture, the blessings, you know, and to realize that it was very, very near that very spot that Jesus was able to give this marvelous sermon. And that's, of course, just an absolute thrill. And there are other spots like it, too. It's just, I'm not trying to say that whenever you go over there, you're going to be totally disappointed. Of course not. There are many spots that are authentic and are just a wonderful, faith-quickening experience.
How many times have you made this trip?
I hate to admit it, about 8 times, I guess.
Any particular personal stories from those trips that stay in your mind?
Well, just to see the way that Christian pilgrims are really touched by being on site. It's sometimes a little difficult, you know, with tourist schedules and where's the next meal coming from and this kind of thing to try to spirit yourself back 2,000 years. But it's easy to do once you get in the proper spiritual atmosphere over there and see how the sites very beautifully bear out the biblical descriptions.
Well, how many are you going to do this again? I'm thinking somebody's listening to us and they're saying, boy, I would love to go to the Holy Land with Dr. Paul Meyer. And how often do you do this? Will you do it again? Do you welcome contact from folks on something like this?
Well, we had to turn down about 50 people for this last tour, and so I'm offering it again at the end of May next year, for the 13th of May in 2009.
And you personally take everybody everywhere, and you share the depth of your historical and biblical knowledge. You lead the tour, right?
I lead the tour. That's right. But we have to use local guides as well, which I regularly correct.
How's that go over?
Well, I have a little numbering system that I hold up numbers behind the head of the guide while he's talking to my groups, and I use a 1 to 10 scale for authenticity. Yeah, 10's absolutely authentic, and 1 is forget about it. And so I've been known to, hold a 0 or a 1 or 2 or 3 behind the guide's head while he's talking, asking my group not to smile.
Is it dangerous in Palestine these days?
Well, there's always a little bit of concern, I guess, but look, while we were over there, a bomb went off in New York City. Where is it safe in this world?
Yeah.
The whole existence here is a little edgier than it used to be, and so I don't think it's any more dangerous than walking through Central Park.
Will, if I were to make this trip with you, will I be changed forever?
Possibly. I'm sure it'll be for the better.
I could use some of that, actually, as you probably know. What do people tell you when you're flying back? What do people tell you? What do they say? Oh, Dr.
Well,
Meyer, I'm so glad I came.
It's so touching to see how touched they have been. And, some try to tip me, and I immediately, of course, refuse that. But some will send a letter later on telling me how much they appreciate it and so forth. And it's not due to me. It's due to the experience.
All right. We are at the bottom of the hour here, Dr. Meyer. If we can get you to hang on through the break, we'll come back to you in just a moment. You're listening to the Bible Study. This is an Ask the Pastor Hour. I'm Chuck Rathard. We have with us Dr. Paul Meyer, who is professor of ancient history at Western Michigan University in Kalamazoo. Our telephone numbers, if you have a question for Dr. Meyer, are 505-7850 and 1-800-730-2727. Those of you listening to our radio station will be able to listen in on a live worship broadcast beginning at 12 noon. We will bring you a Traore service, a Good Friday Traore service from Timothy Lutheran Church in St. Louis, a 3-hour service from noon to 3 here today, immediately following our Ask the Pastor conversation with Dr. Paul Meyer. Stay with us.
Have you ever experienced a form of injustice against you? Perhaps you can even remember the exact time or the day of the week it occurred. Would you call that day a good day? Then why do we refer to the day that God died as Good Friday? We'll talk about that on Law and Gospel. Join us next time at 3 p.m., right after the Traore service on AM 850 KFUO, Inspirational Christian Radio.
Hello, this is Kay Meyer of Family Shield. You're invited to join me and the Board of Directors of Family Shield Ministries for our Share the Light celebration dinner on Sunday, April 13th at the Holiday Inn Viking Conference Center in St. Louis. The keynote speaker is Reverend Robert Ropner. To receive information or register, call 314-772-6070. That number again, 314-772-6070. 6070.
Were ancient Egyptians able to write? Find out next on today's Creation Moment. And now, here's our Creation Moment host, Ian Taylor.
One of the mysteries of ancient Egypt is that it appears to have begun as a high civilization. The very first pharaoh of Egypt is known as Nama, and his name simply means catfish. From what we can tell, King Catfish, who lived around 500 years after the Great Flood, is helping to prove the truth of the Bible's history. It was long thought that writing had not yet been invented at the time of King Catfish, or even at the time of Moses 400 years later. But recent discoveries of writing on both carved stone slabs and papyrus-like paper from the time of King Catfish have shown that even at this early date, writing had been around for a long time. Even more amazing has been the discovery from Catfish's time of a well-organized industrial complex which had many production facilities, each specializing in the production of certain types of fired clay pots. The ruins clearly show that this industrial complex shipped its products all over the ancient Egyptian empire. One thing is clear. Those who argue that Moses could not have written the early books of the Bible because they believe that writing had not at that time been invented have been clearly proven wrong by old King Catfish.
To get a complete set of transcripts from Creation Moments programs, ask about the book Letting God Create Your Day when you visit us online at creationmoments.com or call us toll-free at 1-800-42-BIBLE. That's 1-800-422-4253. And be sure to join us next time for another Creation Moment, proclaiming evidence of God's truth.
AM 850 KFUO will honor a long-standing tradition again this year by broadcasting a live Traore, or three-hour Good Friday service. This year's broadcast comes from Timothy Lutheran Church in St. Louis and runs from noon until 3 p.m. Pastor Ron Rawl is inviting worshipers to attend the service in person at Timothy at 6704 Filer Avenue in St. Louis. Or be listening Good Friday for our Traore broadcast here on AM 850 KFUO.
On the next Joy, we've been cooling our jets for weeks now, just waiting to share with you the joyous music of Easter. Music by Bach, Handel, John Rutter, and so much more. And now it's almost here. This is Ron Clem. We'll wait just a little while longer if you promise to join us this week for our Easter edition of Joy. Listen for Joy on the web at KFUO.org and Sunday afternoons at 4:05 on AM 850 KFUO.
Our numbers are 505-7850 and 1-800-730-2727. Our guest is Dr. Paul Meyer, who, while being a professor at Western Michigan University, is also an elected officer of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. The church body has a president and then five vice presidents, which probably makes for a pretty good six-handed pinochle game. That's the way I figure it. And he is the second vice president of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. Do you play pinochle, Dr. Meyer?
I regret. No, I don't.
Oh, well, there goes that. I guess I had that wrong. Let's take this telephone call, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Hi, Linda. You're on the Bible study.
Hello.
Good morning.
I think I heard something on the news. Was it last week or so that they found a temple, I think, over in Jerusalem?
Temple?
Huh?
The temple you're talking about?
Yes.
The ancient...
ancient temple,
oh.
Yeah.
And which one? I hadn't heard that.
Huh?
I had not heard that.
Or I thought I heard that. Was it my imagination?
Well, let's ask Dr. Meyer if he's got any information on that.
Okay.
Thanks for the call. Dr. Meyer, have you heard anything
about that? Well, if you're talking about the Great Temple in Jerusalem, that the site has never been lost, and so everybody knows where that has been the last 2,000 years. So it must be maybe a cultic temple of some kind, maybe from Solomon's time. You know, he had all his multiple wives had various religious systems, so maybe it's that one. I hadn't heard about it when I was over there. Sorry about that.
I remember hearing a few years ago, we had always understood that one of the reasons why the ancient temple of Israel could not and has not been rebuilt is because one of the most holy shrines in all of Islam, the Dome of the Rock, presently rests on that site. And then I heard that somebody had used new technology, the kind of technology that uses sound and reverberation to look beneath the soil. They use this now to excavate for dinosaur bones. And that they had found a foundation for the temple which was actually not on the side of the Dome of the Rock, but was to the side of it. And this was a great revelation. You remember hearing anything like that?
Yes, that there's been a disputed locational situation regarding the Temple of Solomon. The fact of the matter is, though, that Herod the Great built the temple foundations right on the Solomonic foundations. So we know that the actual Holy of Holies is what we're talking about. That could be adjacent to what is today the Dome of the Rock. That's right. There's, of course, a fierce contention over who has the right to build what on that sacred temple area, because that area is sacred to the three great monotheistic religions in the world. We're talking in chronological order, the Hebrews, Christians, and then, of course, Islam. Islam calls it the Dome of the Rock, the Harem Sharif, the beautiful sanctuary, because it commemorates the place supposedly where Muhammad's horse took off on his famous midnight ride to heaven and back. And that's the reason the Golden Dome is there. And, of course, you couldn't possibly dislodge one stone in that particular monument without getting the world Islam down your neck. So it's an intractable problem. I think the only way, if they ever find a solution, is going to be to internationalize or to absolutely ecumenize some way the control of the temple area.
If I were to speculate, as a Christian, that the reason the temple came down in 70 A.D. at the hands of the Roman general Titus and has never reappeared, in part because the Dome of the Rock holy shrine rests on that site, that shrine is there precisely so the temple can't be rebuilt, because the temple was replaced by the temple of Christ's body, and it would be counterproductive for a new Jewish temple to rise. Would there be any credence to that, or am I just...
Well, frankly, it would be counterproductive to just about anyone's faith to have the cultus of the Old Testament reinstated today, because what are you going to do, you know, in the first part of the scientific 21st centuries with something like animal sacrifice? For goodness sake, according to the laws, you know, in the Old Testament, you'd have to get the bloody business of animal sacrifice started again, and I just don't think that's in the cards.
505-7850 and 1-800-730-2727. If you'd like to share a question or a comment with us, you're certainly welcome to join us with Dr. Paul Meyer. Here's a car phone caller. Hi, Jane. You're on the Bible study.
Hi. I don't know. I just got in my car, so I don't know if you talked about this, but with the Temple Mount, wondering, you know, where Solomon did it and everything, I mean, where Herod the Great did it. I know, Paul, Dr. Meyer knows that Herod the Great marked all of his building stones with a certain mark so they can tell, you know, that these are the ones that he did and where they are. And also you can go into the tunnel that goes alongside the Wailing Wall now and see exactly where that mount was, which is interesting. So if that's kind of just something I'd like to see, if he'll say that that's true.
Have you been to Israel, Jane?
Uh-huh.
All right.
Thank you. Bye.
That means that we got now two people who have, and I'm the only one who hasn't. What are your comments, Pastor?
Well, Jane's exactly correct, and there's no problem identifying the Herodian masonry because the beautiful margined-off stones are Herodian. Later on, they'll be just blocks, but Herod's great ashlars, as they're called, have a gorgeous 2-inch margin on all four sides, beautifully dressed, beautifully embossed, ashlars, as they're called, and they're tremendous in size. One weighs almost 60 tons. It's just hard to believe that they could build with stones like that. You know, today we can do it with hydraulics, and so today we build in cinder block size with hydraulics. Go figure that one. in the ancient world. They're masochists, I guess. They just loved tugging and pulling heavy weights, heavy weighted stones.
Is there significance to Jerusalem prior to the time of Christ? Well, even prior to the time of David, I guess, is what I'm asking here. Was Abraham in any way associated with the area that eventually became the city of Jerusalem?
Well, yes, the tradition is that this is the same as Mount Moriah, where Abraham almost sacrificed Isaac, you recall. And therefore, David, when he laid the foundations of the location of the great temple, which he was not permitted to build, he provided kind of a temple building kit for his son Solomon, because David's hands were too bloody with war and conquest to be allowed to do that. But that's the reason he chose that particular site.
505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Let's go to St. Charles and talk to Linda. Hi, Linda. You're on the Bible study. Good morning.
Well, you just answered my most important and main question.
Well, that would make us prophetic.
Yeah,
well,
maybe.
Maybe. Probably not.
The other one was, do we know the location in the Jordan River where Jesus was baptized? And if so, I'm wondering if maybe Dr. Meyer could give a brief description. My voice wondered what that looked like, that area.
All right. Thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Dr. Meyer?
Jesus was baptized along the banks of the Jordan River, probably at the lower part of the Jordan before it emptied into the Dead Sea. Today it hardly empties anything into the Dead Sea because water is so very precious that the Dead Sea is evaporating more and more. I hate to tell you, but the Dead Sea is dying.
Hmm.
And there are plans to rescue it, by the way, by digging a canal that will bring seawater into the Dead Sea, which will save it, because there's no pumping involved, because the Dead Sea is 1,300 feet below sea level. It's the lowest place on Earth where you can still breathe, so there'll be no problem there at all in bringing in waters from the Mediterranean to the west, or probably from the Red Sea to the south. But that place is probably been rediscovered. The Jordanians have control of this one at a place, I would say, about 8 miles north of Jericho, along the lower portions of the east bank of the Jordan River.
In Jesus' day, would the Jordan River have been a pretty big river or just a fairly small stream?
Well, it's still a very functioning river, and it's nothing to sniff at. It has good current. That is, if you don't get to the southern extent of it. The southern extent by now will have drawn off fresh water for irrigation purposes, both for the Israelis and also for the Jordanians. And so that's why hardly any water comes into the Dead Sea via the Jordan River. But in Jesus' day, it would, of course, have been strong and rushing.
Now, do I recall that you said that on your trip to Israel that you also went to Egypt?
Yes.
I know that Jesus went to Egypt with his parents when he was little, and I certainly am aware of the story of the Exodus and how Egypt figures there. What am I going to see and do in Egypt that would be of interest to me as a Bible student when I go with Dr. Paul Meyer?
Well, of course, you have the whole Old Testament dimension in regard to Egypt. You have Abraham himself, you know, going to Egypt for a while with Sarah. And then you have Joseph and his brothers selling him into slavery in Egypt. You have the long sojourn in Egypt for 400 years. And then the final deliverance from Egypt under Moses. So there's many, many Old Testament accounts that are associated with Egypt. And then the New Testament, of course, you have Jesus and the Holy Family being there, probably briefly. It wasn't at Cairo like they claim, local guides claim, at St. Sergius Church there. Shows you the very spot where the Holy Family lived and so on.
That's unlikely. Not true? Unlikely, you say?
Unlikely, yeah. They probably went to Alexandria. You see, Alexandria boasted a huge Jewish population. There were more Jews living in Alexandria, Egypt, 2,000 years ago, than in Jerusalem. And so there'd be no problem with the Holy Family finding shelter with fellow members of the House of David.
Are there spots left in Egypt? Are there places to visit in Egypt that somehow connect to Bible times, things that you can look at, like going to Jerusalem to look at Golgotha or the Tomb of the Holy Sepulchre and things like that?
Well, of course, the main geographical parameters are the same. The Nile River is very, very big, was, is, and always shall be, as far as Egypt is concerned. And the Russias, you know, along the bulrushes along the Nile, they're still there, where baby Moses was found. You know, this is all very, very realistic. And then Moses himself is an Egyptian name. One of the great conquering pharaohs was Thutmose III. And that simply means, you know, drawn from the river.
How many days does your tour take?
Well, we spend a week in Israel and a week in Egypt.
So it's 2 weeks long?
Mm-hmm.
And are you at liberty to say about how much it costs if people are interested in...
Yeah, ours was $3,400.
$3,400 per person?
Yeah, New York to New York.
Does that take care of...
Takes care of everything except lunches.
Lunches. I tell you, I think I'd like to do that. I don't know if I could find 2 free weeks like that, but I would certainly like to do that. All right, can I change directions here a little bit?
Sure, help yourself.
Dr. Meyer, in church on Sunday, some people will be hearing an epistle reading, which is from Colossians chapter 3, verses 1 to 4, Colossians chapter 3. Which in the New International Version has a subtitle right after Colossians 3, which says, Rules for Holy Living. And then verses 1 through 4 read, Since then you have been raised with Christ. Set your hearts on things above, where Christ is seated at the right hand of God. Set your minds on things above, not on earthly things. For you died, and your life is now hidden with Christ in God. When Christ, who is your life, appears, then you also will appear with him in glory. I'm smart enough to figure out why this might be a reading that would be used on Easter Sunday, because it's all about resurrection. But it's about resurrection in the context of my resurrection, which I'm not so sure I've spent a whole lot of time thinking about. Can you react to these four verses here in Colossians chapter 3, since then you, Dr. Meyer, have been raised with Christ?
Well, I certainly think it's appropriate for every Christian to examine the account, to check out its historicity, and then see how it applies in his or her own life. And so for that reason, it's appropriate enough, I would think. I do have a private quarrel with many of the epistle and gospel selections and pericopes, as we call them, for the church year. I sometimes wonder about the committees, the interdenominational committees that decide on these. And I'm not ready to start a revolution in that regard, but this might be a case in point where I think there might have been a little bit more emphasis on the historical details on this history-laden Holy Week.
We had a caller who called in and asked a question which I don't understand, but apparently she thought you would understand it. She wants to know if Mount St. Catherine is truly what it is claimed that it is. Does that ring a bell with you?
Oh, sure.
Can you explain it to me? I'm a novice.
We're trying to determine if Mount Sinai, per se, can be identified today. And it's not really called Mount St. Catherine. It's St. Catherine's Monastery, which was built at the base of what was considered for centuries to be the true Mount Sinai. The Arabs call it Jebel Musa, the Mountain of Moses. And there is an alternate version that's very popular lately, circling the internet, about Mount Sinai instead has been in Arabia somewhere across the Gulf of Aqaba. A book was written about it, The Gold of the Exodus, and so on. I'm not convinced really by that evidence yet, or I'm not sure that I will be, because I have climbed Mount Sinai, the Jebel Musa segment that the church has always regarded for the last 18 centuries as indeed the Mountain of Moses, and it fulfills the parameters of the Old Testament story magnificently. There's a big broad plain in front of the mountain where the children of Israel could indeed have set up a camp city, and so it really fulfills everything I'd like to see. But the great monastery at St. Catherine's was terribly important, by the way, because of New Testament manuscript research. Because in the 1880s, a German scholar of the New Testament named Konstantin Tischendorf was looking for early versions of the Bible. And he arrived at this particular monastery, which was known to house an old collection. And there he found, indeed, the pages of what came to be known as the Codex Sinaiticus, the Book of Sinai, which is presently in the British Museum in London. One of the earliest groups to pioneer the idea of switching to books rather than scrolls was Christian Church. And so what they did was to take these two column segments in the scrolls and bind them together at the edge, and ta-da, there we have it, a book. And the Codex, as it was called.
Uh-huh.
And so that's what Tischendorf discovered, very, very important manuscript.
Let's see, now, I learned something there. You know, there was a story on the Associated Press wire today, which I thought was kind of fascinating, and I wondered what your reaction to this might be. There is an American Christian who believes that God is going to use his company to bless Israel with oil. Quote, the blessings of the deep that lie beneath, prophesied in the Bible's book of Genesis, he says. His name is John Brown. He's founder and chairman of Zion Oil and Gas, and he says an exploratory well suggests that there's a lot of oil there in Israel, which could be brought into production as soon as this summer. Brown considers it the fulfillment of the Jewish patriarch Jacob's blessing on his son Joseph in Genesis 49:25, and believes the anticipated oil strike will bless Israel and prove the Bible is true. What's your reaction to that story today?
Well, I think it'd be a wonderful coincidence if it did happen, and I'd wish Israel well in that respect, no question about that. But that is not the way I would try to prove the Bible true. There's too many easier ways to prove the Bible true in terms of the geographical locations, in terms of the archaeological artifacts, hard evidence, and the historical documents. That's a much easier way to prove the Bible true.
So, as you as a historian watch the various events that are unfolding in the Middle East, as you observe the Iraq War and the rise to prominence of Iran and terrorism and Islam versus everybody, I guess. Do you have any end time thoughts as you watch this these events unfold, Dr. Meyer? Does anything strike you as significant, or is it business as usual?
Well, I'm a little prone to react to any eschatological conclusions in that regard, simply because that's what the prophecy people have been yelling at us now for the last 40 years, you know, ever since Hal Lindsey's late great Planet Earth, and now with the Left Behind series. They've all been trumpeting the idea that the end is just around the corner because of these apocalyptic events that seem to be hovering over the climate of the Near East. Well, the fact of the matter is the Near East has been a cockpit of controversy, you know, for the last 18 centuries. And so there's not all that much new here, although it could be. Who knows? It's just that I think we got to be careful as good Christians to communicate the basic good news of our faith, which is our justification through Jesus Christ's atoning merit on this day, Good Friday, 2,000 years ago. That's the news of Christianity and the glorious resurrection coming on Sunday. Not amateurish forecasting on when this is actually going to take place.
Just a few minutes remaining here on our Ask the Pastor Bible Study. We have a call from Perryville, Missouri, and we're going to talk with Pearl. Hi, Pearl. You're on the Bible Study.
Hi. I got a question for Dr. Meyer.
Yes, sir.
When Moses took the Israelites over into Egypt, and they were grumbling and growling, and, you know, they didn't have no water, no food, so on Mount Horeb, he struck a rock. I don't know if it's pronounced right. Is that water still running out of that rock?
All right. Dr. Meyer?
Well, I think it was at Rephidim. There is a site, an oasis in Rephidim in the Sinai Peninsula, which does have water cascading out of apparent rocky formation, so it could be the one.
Could be the one?
Yep.
The history of the things that you've studied that's 2,000 years old, which seems like so, so long ago to us, do you feel, is it more proximate to you? Does 2,000 years feel like a shorter time than it does for me? Does that make sense, that question?
Yeah, it really does. I since I'm located in the ancient world, you know, I feel sort of the world's been going downhill ever since the fall of the Roman Empire.
You know, when I was a kid, I thought 1940 was ancient history.
Yeah, I know. Exactly. Exactly.
And I've come to feel like 2,000 years ago isn't quite as long ago as I used to think it was.
Well, when you're over there, you're just looking at time. You're just looking at antiquity. And the mental set there is far more comprehensive in terms of history and dimension and background than we're used to in the hurry up West.
We have about 2 minutes left here, and I have time to ask you one more question. And that is for Dr. Paul Meyer, a long career both as a pastor and as a historian. What's the one thing from your perspective, your unique perspective, that you would like people to take from their Good Friday worship activity today?
Well, basically the idea that our faith is based on fact and not on fiction. If you compare the credentials of Christianity with the credentials of all the other world religious systems, with the exception of our parent Judaism, all the rest are built on what one founder claims to have received from God. And I would hope that they would never entrust their spiritual future in the hands of one person, man or woman, who claims to get God's revelation. I think the beautiful thing about the Christian faith is it is based on a cloud of witnesses. You have patriarchs and prophets in the Old Testament. You have apostles and evangelists in the New Testament, the culminating revelation in Christ. That's a crowd you can trust. And what a difference that is between our faith and the others.
Dr. Paul Meyer, thank you for the privilege to visit with you here on this Good Friday. I always love listening to you and your insights, and God's blessings on your Good Friday Passion Observation and celebration of the resurrection this week.
Same to you. Delighted to talk to you.
The Reverend Dr. Paul Meyer here, a guest on our Ask the Pastor Bible Study, second vice president of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, professor of ancient history at Western Michigan University in Kalamazoo, and our guest here on our Bible study program. We wish the greatest of blessings to all of you who regularly listen to the Bible study as you look forward to the celebration of the resurrection of our Lord this coming Sunday. And we will get back to the business of Matthew on Monday. Thanks so much for listening.
Listen to Chuck Rather and guests Monday through Friday at this same time on The Bible Study. The Bible Study is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is needed for The Bible Study to continue. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can contact us on the Internet at kfuo.org. For a free copy of The Bible Study, please visit the audio archive section of our homepage. That's kfuo.org. The Bible Study is a broadcast service of Worldwide KFUO.